pushed him down at the same time.
Okay. Are we in business again?
Yes. We're in business.
Okay. All right, so Zeke put the money into the, got the money put in the proper place in the budget, and I did a detailed process design on this thing, and then it was turned over to a much larger firm to do all the detailing on it, and I was reviewing all of their drawings and so forth, and was there for the startup of the plant, and of course it worked. And we got a lot of information out of it.
At what scale did it work? What do you remember?
It was, I believe, a ton an hour. It was a 30-inch diameter vessel operating at a ton an hour level. That's not insignificant. It turns out a fair amount of the material. And to the best of my knowledge, by the way, I might add that this type of gasifier is the dirtiest kind of gasifier. And it was operating on bituminous coal, eastern bituminous coal, which is the dirtiest kind of coal. And the output of this plant, of this clean gas, was clean enough to burn directly in the gas turbine. And to the best of my knowledge, that was the first time that had ever been done. And as a matter of fact, it was quite a long time afterward till that was repeated.
In other words, the gas turbine combustion feed did not contain grit oxides that had been separated out.
Well, there are a number of things that come out of the gas. First of all, there are tars that come out.
Yeah,
you have to get rid of the tars.
What about those bits?
I'll get to them in a minute. Then there are oils that are somewhat contaminated. There are a whole raft of organic compounds, smelly, filthy, carcinogenic, nasty compounds. The process that I designed could not only collect these materials, but it could contain them and either use them or destroy them. In fact, many of them were reused in the process. In addition to that, there are the sulfur compounds. Sulfur comes out as H2S, hydrogen sulfide, and carbonyl sulfide. Carbonyl sulfide is a whole separate problem. For that, I located the catalyst and we demonstrated that we could convert the carbonyl sulfide to hydrogen sulfide, in which form it could be removed. Then, of course, there are the particulates. The particulates are relatively easy to get out by comparison. What isn't so easy to get out are the alkali metals. The alkali metals, by and large, are the things that glue in gas turbines. The system was so effective that the alkali metals were reduced to about the 1 or 2 part per billion level, at which point the gas turbine would tolerate it. So that was my first project with the Department of Energy, and then that plant was run, that facility was run many, many times, and we got a lot of data from it, and we learned different things about the hardware that we needed to change and improve and so forth. So it was a great learning experience for that kind of thing. And I was involved with a lot of other things in coal gasification.
That's the overall title, coal gasification. So,
this was at a period of time when there were long gasoline lines and when it was...
What is that, coal gas? What's the third word?
Coal gasification.
Oh, gas.
G-A-S-I-F.
Nobody's going to be able to understand.
I-C-A-T-I-O-S.
That's an important term.
Well, it's hard to talk about what you do unless you talk about what you do.
That's right.
That's okay. We have the tape.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll take off the tape. And this just gives an indication two of where, you know, in five, the first 5 minutes or the first 10 minutes, approximately what you're talking about. It's very approximate.
All right.
This coal gasification effort.
Incidentally, excuse me, let me make this point. All of the organic materials recovered from this plant could be recovered and recycled and reused, which was a way of getting rid of an otherwise impossible material, because the tarry gunky materials are almost impossible to get rid of by any other means, by biological means or any other.
Yeah. The coal gasification project went on for a very long time, and apparently has been now set aside for a while.
Well, coal gasification was at its peak when this country was worried about energy shortage and gasoline shortage and so forth.
Jimmy Carter's era.
Yes. And the problem with it, of course, is that it's hard to make the economics of a process that complex on a material like coal comparable in costs to $20 a barrel gasoline.
What dollar?
$20 a barrel. It varies.
Yeah, okay, that's good enough. That's good enough. Yeah.
So, consequently, and this country has always been short-sighted in many ways. They built this enormous gasification plant in Great Plains. And in fact, I consulted the Great Plains on some of their problems as well. And that plant ran for quite some while. And it produced product. And of course, it was subsidized by the government, and it was a demonstration plant. Unfortunately, the Department of Energy, I do not believe, wound up keeping the know-how that they developed in a recoverable form. It was always my thought that sooner or later we would need this technology, and we would want to fall back on it, and at which time it would be very nice to have the know-how available to us. And I knew exactly how I wanted that to happen at a very low key level. And it could have been done, but it wasn't politically popular, so it didn't happen. It is not difficult to gasify coal. What is difficult is to do it and live up to the environmental conditions that you want to meet. And coal gasification was used before natural gas was available widely in this country. Way back when.
My childhood in Brooklyn was all on coal.
I think in the 1920s it was probably.
Yes. All the gas in all the big cities of America were in big tanks came from that.
Came from coal gas.
Okay, so that was another job and relationship. Were you basically on fixed price per contract, or were you mostly working on submitted so many hours?
It was on a cost plus a fee. Yeah. And I might add that it sounds like all of these things happened with me working totally by myself, which is not true. Because
Chris, we knew that. Go ahead.
I had
over the years you had a number of associates.
At one period I had something like four or five draftsmen and five engineers working while we were turning out various projects simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
We did one for Vulcan Materials down on Neville Island.
Who?
Vulcan Materials.
Vulcan, V-U-L-C-A-M.
Vulcan Materials recovered metals, mm-hmm. particularly tin, from tin mm-hmm. cans, and from tin plate,
mm-hmm.
and converted these into tin chemicals. And I first worked with them in getting their boiler approved by the county, by Allegheny County Pollution Control. And then I designed a tin chemical plant
mm-hmm.
for them.
Okay. Bob, since we're not an agency for chemical engineering, it's a pretty good picture of your working career. Let me ask you some questions.
I would like to say one more thing.
Yeah, one.
Because almost all of these experiences were on first-of-a-kind situations, I worked with a number of research and development organizations, and by experience learned most of the ways not to do things. So I evolved into consulting on the management of research and development.
Okay.
And I did a good deal of this with the Department of Energy,
mm-hmm.
as a for instance.
Right, I forgot about that.
And that was sort of an evolution mm-hmm. from the technical into the managerial. And that was interesting.
Yeah, that was toward the end.
Quite productive.
Yeah, toward the end of your career.
Well, perhaps the last 5 years.
Last 5 years, yeah. Okay, that's a pretty good picture of your career. That's enough on that. I wanted to ask you, did being Jewish ever make a difference, either when you were first working in the company or whether you were consulting? Did it ever come up in any relationship?
Except for the one occasion that I told you about on a previous tape. It never, ever again came up.
Never again.
And to the best of my knowledge, it was never a hindrance to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
I mean, I always stood on my performance.
That's right. Yeah. I thought that sometimes. Okay, good enough on that. And, stop it. With your family life and your, you know, your social life, was it significant particularly?
Well, it was significant to the extent that it took up an awful lot of time, and
that's true for all of us.
That's right. I don't claim uniqueness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only saying that it did put a definite cap on the amount of time that I could spend with my family. And the more successful my engineering work became, the less time I had. I can't say that any particular social life evolved out of my professional contacts. Although there are people in it that I count as very good friends, you among them. Zeke Clark is one of the oldest friends I have, and we still visit and keep in touch. As a matter of fact, one time I was the executor of their wills, until that became impractical by the way of distance.
Mm-hmm. Let me switch subject again. What of our Jewish religious organizations were you and your family participating in during your working lifetime?
Well, mainly as a family, we were members of the Rosh Hashanah Temple.
Mm-hmm. Do your kids go to a religious school there?
And our kids went to religious school there.
Mm-hmm.
And the religious school was such that both of them were really turned off.
You mentioned that.
We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
The which is unfortunate, but probably might not happen in today's climate, but it did happen back then.
How about for yourself?
And for myself, I never demanded very much of it. I didn't participate very actively in any of the organizations that were connected with it. Now I have more time and I'm on the board of Temple Brotherhood and so forth, but back then I just I didn't have the time or the inclination.
Did you buy a check?
All the spare time I had, I really wanted to spend with the kids while they were growing up.
Clearly.
And,
did you ever have an encounter of any sort with Rabbi Freehoff or anybody else over there?
Yes, I remember Rabbi Freehoff very well. I always thought that Rabbi Freehoff, if he had been Catholic, would have been Pope.
Would have been or should have been?
Would have been.
Mm-hmm. Is that supposed to be good?
Well, it speaks to the fact that Rabbi Freehoff was a very political animal. And maybe I should tell you the story of the time Marcia and I decided to go to the temple, and we brought Bruce along and parked him in the babysitting part, which they had provided, which Temple had provided, and then after services we picked Bruce up. And Bruce wanted to go see where Mommy and Daddy prayed, so we brought him up, and Rabbi Freehoff was still there, so we introduced Bruce. And Bruce looked up at Rabbi Freehoff and he said, "Is that God?" And the thing I remember about Rabbi Freehoff is that he didn't deny it. Anyway.
Was Julie any smarter?
All right, I have that's
the kind of question I prefer not to have worded.
What do you think was your most significant thing, accomplishment, you know, aside from your family in your work situation? Because you did so many things. Was there one thing that stood out?
Well, I was on so many interesting projects and was able to innovate and to invent and to make things happen that never would have otherwise happened. And it's hard for me to pick one over another because each one of them had its own peculiar characteristics and its own peculiar problems that that had to be overcome in order to make them happen. Well, I don't really prefer one over another because each one in its own time, and I might say, by the way, that each time I encountered one of these problems, or one of these projects, one of these impossible, they were all impossible projects. They all started out as impossible projects. And each time I encountered one, I would think, I wonder if I'm going to be able to bring this one off. And the only thing that buoyed me up was the fact that I'd always done it before, so I had hopes.
I want to switch again. Did you have any encounter whatsoever with the city or state political system in any way, with the mayor or the city councils?
Almost none. The major encounter I had with local organizations was when Allegheny County put in the Sierra Pollutions Article 18. And I had a number of clients who were in deep trouble. And I was helping to work them out of trouble, and I had a very good reputation with the hearing board, because when I said it was going to be done, it was done. So they trusted my clients because I was standing in front of them.
Do you remember the leadership of GASP by any chance? And
Michelle Madoff was, I think, the founder of GASP, and very interesting person. I mean, I had a lot of fun with Michelle. Michelle used to come to me with all kinds of questions. One thing I give her credit for, she knew what she didn't know, and she asked questions. Mm-hmm. And she did inform herself. Mm-hmm. Michelle was a somewhat fragile person. Brittle becomes fragile.
Sometimes you never can tell that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, she could make life miserable for some organizations and some people, but nevertheless, she was herself pretty fragile.
What happened to her?
She left and went to North Carolina.
Yeah, she's living with some gentleman in North Carolina,
yeah,
and apparently happy there. Mm-hmm.
She got divorced from
some
guy.
I know.
Yeah, and I've asked about the politics. Your doctors, have they served you well?
My doctor, you mean my medical doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had...
Nothing to complain of.
Oh, no, indeed. I mean, I owe my very life to a couple of...
Who?
I was working in Coppers, and I came home with a, I was just really feeling rotten, and I had a stomach ache, and I went to the infirmary and got something for it. The nurse was concerned. I said, "Don't worry, I don't have appendicitis." And I came home, and I went to bed, and I just couldn't move.
Mm.
And the buddy cats came to see me, and he said, "You've got to get up and go be tested."
Mm-hmm.
So I hauled myself out of bed and went to see Sidney Rosenberg. And Sidney sent me upstairs for a blood count, and when I came down, the blood count was out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, "We're going to operate this afternoon."
Mm-hmm.
And when they operated, my appendix were already perforated.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while to bounce back to full strength from that. But actually, this happened over December and Christmas and New Year's holidays, as a result of which I think I only missed about 2 days' work. We were in the middle of designing this plant, and you know, nothing could wait. We were in the middle of designing this great work plant.
Mm-hmm.
All these guys were depending on
me. You say cat C or K?
K.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've had very good succession of doctors.
Yeah. You mentioned your kids' hard luck with their religious upbringing at the Rudolph temple at Rudolph. Yeah. How about household? How much Jewish ritual did you maintain during their lives here?
Well, we maintained the holidays, and we did our Friday night benching, and we weren't excessive in any respect, but we touched all the bases.
That's they were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Academy for you caught that in the middle of the sentence. The Academy for Lifelong Learning at Carnegie Mellon University was initiated about 5 years ago, and Marcia and I were among the founding members of all. Steve Calvert came from Dartmouth, brought with him the idea of this lifelong learning program for senior adults, put on by the senior adults themselves. as a total volunteer program. And we became wrapped up in the idea. It seemed like a good one, and we were interested in it, and both Marcia and I...
We, Marcia and you.
Right. Marcia and I have always been interested in education. I don't think it came out in any of these tapes, or maybe it did, but I did teach at Carnegie Mellon University several years.
Yeah.
Did we talk about that?
Okay.
Who was your contact at CMU?
Well, let's see. Bob Rothfuss was my... first of all, he taught me the first course I ever took at CMU, and he was the best teacher in chemical engineering that I ever had. And he and I became very good friends.
Talking about who was the father at CMU?
Oh, Steve Calvert.
Well,
that's what I was telling you. Somehow Marcia met him, and he had talked about this thing, this idea that he was bringing, and Marcia said, well, you got to talk to Bob, and I got quite interested in it. So at any rate, I was part of the curriculum committee of all from its very inception, and along the line, there were three curricula chairmen, Jack Feeney then turned over a whole program to me, and I picked it up and did it. And then for 2 years, I was chairman of curriculum, and I did the entire thing. And at that time, that involved not only getting all of the study leaders and putting the program together, but making a schedule out of it, getting rooms from Carnegie Mellon, which has not been easy, because after all, the paying students get first choice on the rooms. And incidentally, the way the rooms are divided up there, the registrar doesn't control the rooms. The registrar only controls a small number of the rooms, and all of these departments have these little fiefdoms and control rooms, so you have to have a lot of friends and contacts in order to be able to handle this. Also, registration was under me, too, part of curriculum. So I had this whole smear, and it took up a god-awful lot of time. And not only that, I was expanding the program enormously. And I developed a lot of contacts and was able to... was fortunate enough to be able to find a lot of very, very good study leaders. An interesting thing was, we had a lot of people coming over from the University of Pittsburgh who were full-time professors over there, and were coming over to Carnegie Mellon to lead courses as volunteers because they enjoyed the group so much. And the group is a very interesting group. They're essentially all college graduates, and they're all there because they want to be, and they all have interesting life experiences, and they're all very vocal in their courses. And so these people like to come over. So there were a whole string of them. But,
very nice people, too.
Yeah,
right?
They're lovely people.
Yeah, good course. It's great. It's grown so fast.
Well, we're now up over 500 people. And we're not publicizing it or trying to.
You don't have to.
You're about the same size as the Pitt program.
Well, we have been... You know, there are a number of organizations like this scattered around the United States. We are the fastest growing of any of them. And perhaps as successful as any of them. Because there have been these convocations, you know, where we've met with people from all over the United States and accomplishments have stood out. And one of my concerns with this whole operation was that it depended too heavily on a very small handful of people, and the jobs were too intense to be able to have successors.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I held on to this job for much longer than I intended to or wanted to, because I couldn't find anybody else to take it.
You had
and I didn't want to just drop it.
You have a paid secretarial office?
No, there is no one paid in the whole operation.
No, it's hard to see how you'll get by. But anyway, Pitt's program does have a paid secretarial office.
Well, that's a whole other story. Yeah. I don't want to get into that. I've been in favor of doing that. And Gretchen has been.
Gretchen. Eventually, I think it's going to have to be done.
Oh, of course it will. Of course it will. But at any rate, so one of the big things that I wanted to do, and I did succeed to a large extent, first of all, it was obvious to me we had to split the job up. So I insisted that the registrar became a separate chairmanship and off to one side. We still all worked hand in glove. We had to, but that responsibility had to come out from under curriculum. Then the responsibility for gaining rooms also had to come out from under curriculum. So fortunately, Roland Grant picked that up and took it over, and he's done a splendid job on that. The other thing was, it was obvious the way we were growing and all the things that we had to record, we had to be computerized. And this diddled around and daddled around until finally I brought in Gordon Price.